So yesterday we talked about the second establishment of mindfulness, mindfulness of vedana. Briefly, the third establishment of mindfulness is mindfulness of mind states, simply knowing your state of mind. Are you happy, sad, confused, concentrated, whatever your mind state is. And so you should be checking in throughout the day, both on retreat and when you're not on retreat, and just checking in to see what your mind state is. That particular establishment, you don't do anything about it. You just make a habit of checking in to see what your mind state is. However, doing so, and you discover that your mind state is one of the hindrances, then you can move to the fourth establishment of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of dharmas, and the first practice given under there is mindfulness of the hindrances. We've talked about the hindrances. What it says in the sutta is that one should know whether a hindrance is present or not, and you just noticed it because you were doing third establishment and you found that you were wanting, so it's present. Then you should determine how it came to be, how you can make it go away, and how you can prevent it from arising again in the future. And that's for each of the hindrances. I'm not going to say more about that particular practice. If you discover that your mind state is one of the seven factors of awakening, then you want to keep it around and you bring it to perfection. Okay? And we'll talk about the seven factors of awakening tomorrow. But today I want to talk about another practice in the fourth establishment of mindfulness, which is the five aggregates, the five khandhas. Khanda is Pali, skanda is Sanskrit. And the word means heap or pile. You usually see it translated into English as aggregates. But think of a pile of firewood, okay? And what these are the piles that make up our experience. We experience the world in terms of one of these things. I'll read you what the Buddha has to say. One abides contemplating phenomena as phenomena with respect to the five aggregates of grasping. And how does one do so? Here one thinks, such is form, such is the arising of form, such is the disappearance of form. Such are vedana, such are the arising of vedana, such is the disappearance of vedana. Such is perception, such is the arising of perception, such is the disappearance of perception. Such are mental activities, such are the arising of mental activities, such are the disappearance of mental activities. Such is consciousness, such is the arising of consciousness, such is the disappearance of consciousness. So, quite a lot in here, actually. So it's called the five aggregates of grasping in this particular translation. The five upadana khanda. Upadana is usually translated as grasping or clinging. But it's five upadana khanda. It's five clinging aggregates, which is different from five aggregates of clinging. And this always was like kind of weird. What's going on here? Especially when the Buddha says that dukkha, in short, is the five upadana khanda. And it wasn't until I read a book by Richard Gombrich that he talked about fire at the time of the Buddha, and that the people at that time felt that fire clung to its fuel. Okay, we think the fire is burning up the fuel, but they were seeing the fire clinging to the fuel. And what is meant here is a pun. It's the aggregates, the things that we tend to cling to, but it's also the fuel for the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. We are greedy about some material form that we want, some vedana that we want, some perceptions or thoughts, emotions, memories, or some state of consciousness, right? Or we're averse to it. We're hating it. We want it to go away, or we're deluded about it. And so the five upadana khandhas is the five piles of firewood for the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so nibbana, which means non-burning, is putting out the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. And the way that's done is to see the five aggregates, the five piles of firewood, five heaps of fuel, as impermanent. Okay, because what the Buddha says, for each of the aggregates, one sees the aggregate, sees such as the arising of that aggregate, and such as the disappearance of that aggregate. If you get a deep enough understanding of the arising and passing nature of the world, it reduces the tendency to grab hold and cling to. For example, suppose you go to the beach. I guess you have to go to Western Sweden to get a real beach with real waves, right? There's not much wave action here. But you need a beach with nice big waves and lots of sand. And you take a little kid with you. And you build a sandcastle. You build a really cool sandcastle with turrets and a drawbridge, you know, and a moat and the whole thing. And then a big wave comes along and wipes it out. Are you upset? You start crying? Well, probably not. But the little kid might be crying, right? You understand the nature of sandcastles. They arise and they pass away. I mean, kind of the fun of it is building one and then having it wiped out by the wave. Okay, well, I got news for you, people. It's all sandcastles. Every bit of it. When you build a sandcastle, you don't think, oh, this is such a great sandcastle. Let's take it home. We'll dig it up. We'll put it in the trunk of the car. We'll take it home. We'll put it on the dining room table. This does not occur to you because you understand the nature of it. So what the Buddha is saying is for these five aggregates, understand their nature. Understand that they have a tendency to arise and pass away. So, the first aggregate is the aggregate of form, rupa, and this is the material world. This is the things that are solids, liquid, gases, and energy, the four elements that we talked about. Pretty much everything that you encounter has rupa. You know, the rocks got rupa. They don't have any of the other aggregates, but they at least have materiality. But even the rocks change, right? If you go for a hike in a up a mountain, you might notice that you tend to kick rocks more downhill than uphill, right? When you hike up the mountain, you're actually wearing the mountain away. Even the mountains are changing. So nothing has form that lasts forever. You look at this building. It probably was a lot spiffier than this at one point, right? And over time, yeah, there's a little peeling pain and the floors aren't even and, yeah, things are changing. Everything is changing. So notice the arising and passing away of material objects. So that's the first of the aggregates. The second aggregate is Vedana, and we talked about that yesterday. And so when you get a pleasant sensation, how long does it last? I mean, think of the most delicious food you've eaten recently. How long did the Vedana last? You put a bite in your mouth and you got, what, an hour of pleasure out of that bite? No, I don't think so. 15 minutes, 5 minutes, a minute, 30 seconds, well, maybe. But, you know, it just doesn't last very long. And some Vedana that are pleasant are even briefer than that. Right? It's just there and gone. So Vedana are arising and passing away very, very quickly. And yet we have a tendency to run our lives based on running after the pleasant Vedana or running away from the unpleasant Vedana. The third of the aggregates is sanya, which is translated here as perception, and though I said actually more accurate, I think, is conceptualization. So you look up here and you see the Buddha statue. Well, no, you see a colored shape and you conceptualize it as a Buddha statue. If you didn't know anything about Buddhism or Buddha statues, you'd look up here and you wouldn't see a Buddha statue. You might see a statue, some guy with a weird head sitting, right? But, you know, because of your Buddhist background, you recognize it, you conceptualize it as a Buddha statue. We take our sensory input and then we make a concept out of what we've just sensed. You hear sounds out there? What is that? Is that the wind? Is that cars? Is that an airplane? Is that a boat? Is that the waves? It's a sound, right? And whatever you make out of it is your conceptualization of it, right? So that's what's happening in your mind. And when you conceptualize and you realize, oh, it's just the wind. Yeah, it's gone, you know. There might be a little bit of struggle to get it, and then, yeah, fine. Done with that. Not a threat, not something I should be running after. So our concepts tend to arise in our consciousness and pass away quite a lot. Now, we do get concepts and we keep them around for a long time. Like, in a few days you'll be going back to where you live, right? My home. Well, that's a concept, right? It really is just, you know, some wood and metal and glass that's, you know, stuck someplace. And you have conceptualized it as my home. And so that concept sticks around, but you, when you're there, you don't go walking around going, my home, my home, my home. You know, it's like, oh, it's nice to be home. And then you're checking your email or whatever, right? So our conceptualizing happens pretty quickly. And then there's our mental activities, our thoughts, emotions, and memories. They tend to arise and pass away pretty quickly as well. You think about something, but how long does a thought last? The thought is pretty brief. You might have another thought and then another thought and then another thought, but these are changing all the time. You have an emotion. You're feeling happy. Well, how long does the happiness last? I hope it lasts a really long time, but I suspect that, you know, it changes. And your memories. How long do your memories last?
Depends how old you are.
Right, depends on how old you are. But think of all the telephone numbers you've had in your whole life. Now, can you remember all those telephone numbers? Yes. I mean, that was really important. There are a few people who can because they didn't have very many numbers, probably. But, yeah, most people have a lot of numbers. And, you know, the memory's gone. It's not even going to arise again. So the memories are arising and passing. And if a telephone number does come up, it probably doesn't stay very long. And then your consciousness. The thing that you're conscious of changes pretty quickly, right? You're conscious of my voice maybe at this time, and you're conscious of the visual field, but because I'm speaking and saying different words, then you're not conscious of this word for very long, right? It's consciousness is continually moving on, and you're probably moving your eyes. You're probably not staring fixedly at something. And if you become conscious of your sitting and the pressure of sitting, because I just mentioned it, it'll probably go away and you'll be back to thinking about something else. You'll be conscious of something else. So all of this is arising and passing really quickly. The more complex an organism, the more of these aggregates they exhibit. Like I said, the rocks, they just got rupa. They don't seem to have any vedana. But the plants, the amoebas, yeah, they've got vedana. They are responding to the environment in a positive or negative way. Your dog knows the sound of the can opener, right? He's got a perception there. This sound means food, and he comes running, right? So, you know, higher animals have, you know, these sort of things. Do they have thoughts and emotions, dogs and cats? I don't know, maybe. Sometimes it certainly seems like they do. Do they have memories? Yeah. You know, somebody that mistreated an animal comes around and that animal remembers, nah, don't stick around this guy, and runs away. So they seem to have memories, but are they like ours? Or we don't know, really. And then consciousness, yeah, they're conscious in the sense that they are aware of things. I don't really think the trees are aware. I don't know about amoebas. But your dog is aware, right? But self-consciousness, which is really a higher form of consciousness, that seems to be limited to humans and the great apes and whales and dolphins and ravens. Ravens can distinguish their own call from other ravens' calls, so they seem to have some sort of self-awareness. But your cat goes up to a mirror and it looks at that cat in there. I remember a cat that we had looking at the cat and then going behind the mirror to find the cat. Yeah. Doesn't realize it's me, right? Doesn't have that self-consciousness that we have. Basically what the Buddha is saying, this is our experience. He's not really saying this is what makes us up, although you certainly hear that taught in Buddhism. But that we're experiencing either physical things or vedana or perceptions or mental activities, thoughts, emotions, memories, or consciousness. And that's what's going on. And he's saying the things that we are experiencing are changing quite rapidly. Now, this is a pretty important teaching. You might have heard that there are suttas where the Buddha gives a discourse and someone or multiple people become awakened at the end of that discourse, reach full enlightenment just because he gave a discourse. How many suttas like that do you think there are? There's 10,000 suttas. Well, there's 10 suttas where the Buddha gives a talk and somebody becomes fully enlightened. There's 2 suttas where Sariputta gives a talk and someone becomes fully enlightened. And there's 1 sutta where the Venerable Kemaka gives a talk. And at the end of his discourse, both he and 60 monks become fully awakened. It's a pretty good discourse. Now, what do you think the most common topic is for those discourses, those 13 discourses? Yeah, it's these 5 aggregates. It's really coming to terms with the fact that, yeah, this is our experience, and it's arising and passing away. So, I want to take a look at another sutta that talks about the aggregates. This is the Majjhima Nikaya, so the middle-length discourses, Sutta 109, the greater discourse on the full moon night. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in the Eastern Park in the palace of Myagra's mother. On that occasion, on the day of the 15th, on the full moon night, so traditionally in Buddhism, the Buddha and the monks would sit up all night on the night of the full moon and the new moon, and also on the quarter moons. Well, now in India, where it's, you know, 40 degrees on a cool day, it makes sense to be awake at night, right? Because then it's probably cooled down to 35 or something, right? So they often would do activities at night. And since if you're meditating, you don't need a lot of light, right? So it gets dark, you sit down, and you just meditate all night. So that's what they were doing. The Blessed One was seated in the open, surrounded by the Sangha of bhikkhus. Then a certain bhikkhu rose from his seat, arranged his upper robe on one shoulder, extended his hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and said, "Venerable Sir, I would like to ask the Blessed One about a certain point." "Sit down, Bhikkhu, and ask your question." So the Bhikkhu sat down. "Are these not, Venerable Sir, the five aggregates affected by clinging, or the five heaps of firewood that we cling to? That is, material form, vedana, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness." "Yes, Bhikkhu, this is correct." "Good, Venerable Sir. But, Venerable Sir, in what are these five aggregates affected by clinging rooted?" Basically, he's saying, why do we cling to them? Well, we find them desirable. "Venerable Sir, is that clinging the same as the five aggregates, or is the clinging something different from the five aggregates?" "Bhikkhu, that clinging is neither the same as the five aggregates, nor is the clinging something apart from the five aggregates. It is the desire and lust in regard to the five aggregates that there is clinging there." So we see some material form, cling to it, mine, right? Or some source of pleasure, some vedana, and we cling to that. Or some perception, the truth, right? That's a conceptualization of the truth or beauty. Or some mental state, some thoughts, emotions, memories, we cling to those. Or some type of consciousness. We find them desirable, the desire and lust. This is good, I want it. And then we cling to it. "But, Venerable Sir, can there be diversity in the desire and lust regarding these five aggregates?" "There can be, Bhikkhu. Here someone thinks thus, may my material form be thus in the future. May my vedana, my perceptions, my mental activities, my consciousness be thus in the future." So sometimes we're thinking about some physical object that we would like to own or keep or whatever in the future. And sometimes we're just thinking about a source of pleasure or getting rid of a source of pain. Or we're thinking about perceptions, conceptualizations such as truth or beauty or something like that. Or thoughts, emotions, memories, or consciousness. "But Venerable Sir, in what way does the term aggregate apply to the aggregates?" So how are these things heaps? In what way does this term heap apply to these heaps? "Bhikkhu, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal, external, gross or subtle, inferior, superior, far or near, this is the material form aggregate." And then the same for each of the others. Past, present, future, internal, external, gross or subtle, inferior, superior, far or near. So just any form, that's part of the aggregate of form. "What is the cause and condition, Venerable Sir, for the manifestation of each of these aggregates?" "Bhikkhu, the four great elements are the cause and condition for the manifestation of the material form aggregate." So any bit of material form that we encounter, it's there because there's solid, liquids, gases, and or energy present at that time. And that's why we encounter it like it is. "Contact is the cause and condition for the manifestation of the vedana aggregate." We'll see this tonight. I'll talk about dependent origination. And vedana arise dependent on sense contact. If there's no sense contact, there's no vedana. Right? I mean, if you've got your eyes closed, you're not getting any visual vedana. Unless, of course, you start seeing things, and then you might get some visual vedana from that. Right? If you're not hearing anything at all, if you're not smelling anything, there's no pleasant, unpleasant vedana. Right now, you probably can't taste anything, so it's no pleasant or unpleasant or neutral vedana. Right? So you need a sense contact. So vedana only rises if there's a sense contact. So that's what's being said here. Contact is the cause and condition for the manifestation of the perception aggregate, the conceptualization. We don't conceptualize anything unless there's something to conceptualize. You can think about something. That's contact at the sixth sense, right? So if I say the first teacher you had when you went to school, then you conceptualize that person, right? But that's a mental conceptualization that's taking place due to the fact you interpreted the sounds I made in my throat, right? So there was contact first at the sound and then at the mental thinking of, oh, my first teacher. And then you conceptualize that teacher, give them a name. Contact is the cause and condition for the manifestation of the mental activities aggregate. We think about things that we perceive with our senses. We have emotions based on what we perceive with our senses. And memories come up triggered by what we perceive with our senses. And this includes the five senses as well as the mind. One thought leads to another thought, leads to another thought. You might have experienced this at some point in the recent past, right? So there's a sixth sense contact, and it just leads to more mental activity. And if the mental activity gets out of hand, it's mental proliferation, which in Pali is papancha. And then name and form is the cause and condition for the manifestation of the consciousness aggregate. We'll see this comes up again in dependent origination. We become conscious of something. Remember I talked about consciousness is vijnana, divided knowing. We become conscious of something by dividing it out from the holistic field. So if it's form, we divide it from the other forms and we become conscious of it, so that it's dependent on form. And if it's an idea, that would be under name, a concept, right? And so we divide that concept out from all the other mental activity and we become conscious of that concept. So the name and form and consciousness work together. You have to be conscious in order to be able to relate to name and form. You've got to have a physical body and it's got to be thinking. It's got to have mental activity for there to be any consciousness. But consciousness, to become conscious of something, also is going to require that you have mental activity and a body. They interrelate. Now we get to the heart of this. Venerable Sir, how does an identity view come to be? So why does somebody think they're a self? Here, Bhikkhu, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for noble ones, is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dharma, regards material form as self, or self as possessed of material form, or material form as in self, or self as in material form, and or regards Vedana, perception, mental activities and consciousness as in self, as self, as possessing an aggregate, as the self is in the aggregate, or self, or the aggregate is in the self, or the self is in the aggregate. So we can pick any of these. As I mentioned, if you're sick, you say, I'm sick. So now my body, that's me. That's what I'm thinking. And so I have now identified the body, the physical body, as myself. But then you might say, this is my hand. Now you're identifying the self as the possessor of the aggregate. And sometimes it seems like there's the little guy sitting behind the eyeballs looking out. So now you've got the self as in the aggregate. And sometimes we get the aggregate in the self, you know, so the thought is inside me, right? So now the aggregate is is in the self that we've made up. So all of the selfing that we do in relation to these aggregates, either as being the aggregate or the owner of the aggregate or being inside the aggregate or the aggregate being inside the one, the self. But Venerable Sir, how does that entity view not come to be? Here, a well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones and is skilled in discipline in their Dhamma, and has regard for true men and is skilled in discipline in their Dhamma, doesn't do that. All right? So someone who is skilled doesn't conceive, I am my body, or I own my body, or myself is inside my body, or my body is inside myself, which is bigger and somehow encompasses it. We don't usually think my body is inside myself, but we do think my thoughts are inside myself, my memories are inside myself. What, Venerable Sir, is the gratification, what is the danger, and what is the escape in the case of each of these aggregates? Okay, so why do we want to hang on to this? What's the gratification for grabbing hold of these aggregates, for clinging to them? And why is that dangerous? And if it's dangerous, how do we get out of this? What's the escape? The pleasure and joy, bhikkhu, that arises dependent on an aggregate, this is the gratification. So yeah, we do get pleasure and joy from the aggregates. It's kind of nice to have a body that works, right? And, you know, you feel strong and you go for a walk and take it out to see nice sights. Yeah, this is gratification there. Or you have a happy thought. You remember something that brings a smile to your face. There's gratification there. So, yeah, the Buddha isn't saying these things are worthless. But he's saying you have to be careful. With the pleasure and joy that arises, there tends to be that clinging. Each of these aggregates is impermanent, dukkha, and subject to change. This is the danger in the case of each of these aggregates. So, yeah, you're happy with your body, but your body doesn't stay that way. You know, it just keeps changing, and it doesn't really seem to be changing back to like it used to be decades ago. It seems to be changing in the other direction. Okay, so changes. The removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for each of the aggregates. This is the escape in the case of each of the aggregates. Okay, so the Buddha doesn't say you have to get rid of the pleasure and joy that arises due to an aggregate. You just have to not get caught in the desire and lust, right? So it's perfectly okay to appreciate your body or your nice memory or the very interesting insight that you just had. Yeah, that's fine. The pleasure and joy that arises from that is fine as long as you don't get caught up in the desire and lust, because things change. And if you're clinging to something that changes, and it changes, it's like picking up the sandcastle and it just going through your hands. Venerable Sir, how does one know, how does one see, so that in regard to this body with its consciousness and all external signs, there's no I-making, mind-making, and underlying tendency to conceit? Okay, so how should we view the world so that I don't make the mistake of making an I out of my body or my mind? Don't make possessions out of material objects or thoughts or anything. And I don't have a tendency to conceive a self. When it says underlying tendency to conceit, it doesn't mean you're conceited. It means an underlying tendency to conceive of a self. So how should I view the world so that I don't conceive of a self? I don't conceive of an entity, and I don't conceive of an owner. Piku, any kind of material form whatever, whether past or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one sees all material form as it actually is with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And the same for each of the other aggregates. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So, all the things of experience, we should see them as the things of experience, not as me and not as mine, and particularly not as myself. Now, the idea of self at the time of the Buddha was more like the idea of soul, the essence of me. It's true from a relative perspective that we do have selves. There's me sitting here in the chair and running my mouth. Okay, there's you sitting there being quiet. So this is from the relative perspective. But the relative perspective won't give us the ultimate freedom that we're seeking. So we need to look from the ultimate perspective. And from the ultimate perspective, whatever we experience, that's not me, that's not mine, that's not my soul. That's not the essence of me that someday is going to be eternally happy, live forever. Because that's what we're after, right? Somehow, some way, I'm going to get to be eternally happy. I'm going to live forever and it's always going to be happy. This is what a lot of religions promise. Just do what we tell you and, yeah, someday you're going to be in this really happy place and you get to live there forever as long as you do what we tell you to do. And the Buddha's going, no, you can't find that part of yourself. All these parts, all these things that you experience, whether you conceive it of yourself or you own it or anything else, it's all changing. None of it is reliable. So what we want to do is see, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself or my soul. It is when one knows and sees thus in regard to this body with its mind and all external signs that there is no I-making, mind-making, or underlying tendency to conceive of a self, a soul. Then in the mind of a certain bhikkhu, this thought arose. So it seems material form is not self, Vedana is not self, perception is not self, mental activities are not self, consciousness is not self. What self then will actions done by the not self affect? Okay, so if there's nobody here, who gets the results of the karma? This is basically what he's asking. All right, so sometimes you hear that phrase, if I don't have a self, what gets reborn? Right? But in a more present moment experience, if there's nobody here and I do an evil action, then who's going to get the result of the evil action? Or if I do a good action, who's going to get the result of that good action?
Isn't that the aggregates?
Well, what the Buddha is going to teach is somewhat different from the aggregates, okay? So, because the aggregates aren't a self, right? So, we can't be, so this bhikkhu thinks, what self then will get the actions, the results done by the not self? So, who gets the result? And it can't be one of the aggregates because they're not the self. Then the Blessed One, knowing in his mind the thought in the mind of that bhikkhu, addressed the bhikkhus thus. It is possible, bhikkhus, that some misguided man here, obtuse and ignorant, with his mind dominated by craving, might think that he can outstrip the teacher's dispensation thus. So it seems that each of these aggregates is not self. Then what self will the actions done by the not self affect? All right, so if you're listening to a talk by the Buddha, you better not go wandering off into idle speculations. Buddha's liable going to know it and call you on it. All right, And so here's the answer. Now, bhikkhus, you have been trained by me through interrogation on various occasions in regard to various things. That probably was not a very satisfactory answer. We have a footnote here. The reading of this sentence are highly divergent in different editions. So the Pali Canon that we have the Sinhalese version from Sri Lanka, and the Burmese version from Burma, and the Thai version from Thailand. And they each have this sutta, but they say something a little bit different. The same sutta appears in the Samyutta Nikaya, and the reading there seems preferable to the reading here. The translation here follows the Samyutta text. Bhikkhu Nanamoli's translation, based on the Sri Lankan version, reads, "Now, bhikkhus, you have been trained by me in dependent conditionality in various instances." Neither version is idiomatic Pali, and the commentaries are silent. It's a good thing the commentaries are silent. They usually get it wrong. Okay? So what the Buddha is actually saying, as far as I can say, to determine, he says, "Now, bhikkhus, I have taught you many times about dependent origination." Okay? So, as we'll see in tonight's talk, don't think in terms of entities, in terms of selves. If you do, you're making a mistake. All there is streams of dependently originating phenomena interacting. Okay? That this body here is the result of previous things that happened. It should be viewed as a verb, not a noun. Because we talk about there's the digestive process, and there's the circulatory process, the endocrine process. So it's a bunch of processes here. It's not a solid entity. And that those processes are dependent on other things. The digestive process needs food for it to work, right? The circulatory process needs the heart to beat, but the heart beating needs food, and it also needs oxygen to burn the food, right? So it also needs to be in reasonably good shape because I've taken it out and gotten it exercise. So I am not an entity. I am the intersection of a lot of streams of dependently arising phenomena. Okay? So you should look at the world not in terms of selves. The bhikkhu who made the mistake said, "What self gets the results done by the not-self?" He wasn't able to let go of the concept of a self. But instead, we should see that there is nothing but streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. Now, this phrase will come up over and over again throughout the rest of this course. I found that it actually is very helpful, at least to me, in understanding what the Buddha is talking about. And you can remember it with sotapai, streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. S-O-D-A-P-I. So it has to be P-I, the Greek letter, because I haven't come up with anything good for E yet. I tried eternally. No, that's no good. Endlessly, I didn't like that. Okay, but sotapai, streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. That's all there is. And we'll see tonight that the Buddha uses the same concept, this way of looking at things in terms of dependently arising phenomena, to answer somebody else's question who has a mistaken view of self. But here, basically what the Buddha is saying is don't think in terms of selves, just look and see that there's nothing but dependently arising phenomena going on. Right? Get rid of this idea of self. As long as you're conceiving of a self, you're not going to be able to understand what's going on. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent dukkha or sukha? Dukkha, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent, dukkha, and subject to change, fit to be regarded? This is mine, this I am, this is myself, this is my soul. Well, since we want our soul to be eternally happy, if it's changing and it's dukkha, that's not going to work. So you probably already got that this material form is not your soul. I mean, you see it growing old, and you probably got figured out that someday it's going to die. So, yeah, to think my body is my eternal soul, that's not going to work. Bhikkhus, what do you think? Are Vedana, perceptions, mental activities, consciousness, permanent or impermanent? Oh, impermanent, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent, dukkha or sukha? Dukkha, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent, dukkha, and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself, my soul. No, venerable sir. Now, this is the teaching that the Buddha gave to the five ascetics that got them all fully awakened, right? He said, basically, look at your experience, both externally and internally, and none of it is permanent. None of it gives you lasting satisfaction. Remember, that's the best understanding of dukkha. Is this the source of lasting satisfaction? The Vedana of breakfast was not a source of lasting satisfaction. I can tell because you're going to go in there and you're going to eat lunch, right? And the conceiving of it's Thursday, well, that didn't give you lasting satisfaction either. And the memory of your first teacher, probably not giving you lasting satisfaction. They're all dukkha, right, in that sense. Okay? And so there, none of this is fit to be regarded as myself, my soul. Therefore, bhikkhus, any kind of material form whatever, whether past, future, present, etc., all material form should be seen as it is actually with proper wisdom, thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, my soul. And the same for Vedana, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness. Seeing thus, a well-taught, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with material form, disenchanted with Vedana, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with mental activities, disenchanted with consciousness. Now, the word disenchantment should be taken literally. Disenchanted. The spell is broken. Right now, we're under the spell that, this is my body, and if I can just get the right food and the right exercise and the right environment, yeah, it's going to be happy. This is my timer, and it makes me happy because, whatever, right? We're under the illusion that there are either things out there or things in here that are going to bring us lasting satisfaction. And once we get them, then we're going to be happy with it. We're enchanted. A spell has been cast over us. When you can see these five aggregates as they are, it breaks the spell and you become disenchanted. Being disenchanted, one becomes dispassionate. Dispassion is the translation of the word viraga. Raga literally means to color. So if you see some graffiti, it's a raga. It's coloring things. You might be familiar with the Indian musical form raga. Mm-hmm. It's called that because it's to color your mind. So we translate raga as passion, but it really means color. In particular, it colors your mind. And so viraga would be not so much dispassion, but your mind is no longer colored by it. Right now, our minds are colored by, this is me, the most important creature in the entire universe. right? And this is my Kindle, and I'm going to go home to my home, and all this other stuff, all right? So our minds are colored by this. Sometimes you see this, well, with sports. You have your favorite football team, and they have their colors, and you're walking down the street, and you see somebody wearing the colors of that other awful team, and you immediately hate this person, right? Your mind is colored by the colors that they're wearing. You have no clue who this person is, but because they're wearing the enemy's colors, yeah, you immediately, your mind is colored, right? So the idea is to overcome this coloring, this passion, become dispassionate. Think of a toy that you had as a kid, something that if it had disappeared, you would have been terribly upset, right? Your mind was colored by that toy. And now you probably don't even know where that toy is, right? And if you do know where it is and it were to disappear, you probably wouldn't get terribly upset, right? You're no longer passionate about it. It's no longer coloring your mind. If your mind isn't colored, then you have a much better chance of clearly seeing what's happening. So by becoming disenchanted with all these things that were coloring our mind is no longer colored by them. We become dispassionate. Through dispassion, one's mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge, it is liberated. One understands, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there's nothing further here. This is the so-called victory cry of the Arhats. Birth is destroyed. The Buddha talked about the deathless, right? And clearly, I mean, if there was anybody that was fully awakened, it was the Buddha, right? And this the one guy we can be absolutely certain about. And yet he died. Did he achieve the deathless? Well, his body died, but he stopped conceiving of a self. So there was no self that died. And if there's no self that dies, well, there's no self that was born, right? The 12-foot tall rabbit standing here is neither born nor is it going to die because it's not really there, right? And once you penetrate the delusion of self, then, yeah, there's no birth and there's no death. So birth is destroyed, the birth of conceiving that there's a me there, this is not happening anymore. The holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, nothing further to do here. And this is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Now while this discourse was being spoken, through not clinging, the minds of 60 bhikkhus were liberated from the intoxicants. Oh, I guess the Buddha had a better delivery. Okay. So, this is one of those suttas where the Buddha talks about the aggregates and 60 bhikkhus become fully awakened. But the key thing here is that we're relating to the universe in terms of either physical form or the Vedana, or the concepts, or the thoughts, memories, emotions, or consciousness. And if we're not careful, we find pleasure in this, and then we cling to it. Or we find something unpleasant, and we cling to getting rid of it. And this clinging leads to dukkha when whatever it is changes, or if it's unpleasant, if it doesn't change like we want it to change. And so we tend to have a tendency for the good stuff to identify with it, either in terms of it's me or it's something I own, and then we conceive of a self. But there are problems with conceiving of a self. It's a delusion. There is no self that can be found. And so if you look at your experience in terms of materiality, Vedana perceptions, mental activities, consciousness, no self can be found. Once you actually penetrate the fact that there's no self to be found, then you become disenchanted with these aggregates. You become dispassionate. You become disillusioned. The illusion is broken, and the tendency for craving and clinging is given up, and one achieves full liberation. Any questions?
Yeah. That question asked by that ignorant
monk. Yeah, the monk whose mind was clouded, yes.
He asked about, we can say, karma.
Right.
Whether actions, who will...
Who gets the action if there's not a self that's doing the action?
Who gets the karma? Who gets the action if there is no self? So, but isn't it as long as you quote an uninstructed worldling?
Uh huh.
Yeah. He conceives himself.
Yes.
As a self.
Right.
So as long as he conceives himself as a self, who will get the result of his actions.
Right. From the relative view.
Yeah, from a relative view, yeah.
Yes. The uninstructing worldling is conceiving that there is a self, and yes, I'm doing this, and I get the results of doing this. Yes. Yeah. Right.
So that I think, is the answer to the question of that monk.
Except, really, the Buddha was talking at the ultimate level. And he's saying, you can't find a self. And so the monk makes the mistake of asking the question on two levels. He says, if there's not a self, what self, relative level, gets the actions done by the not-self, ultimate level? And so the question really doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, as the question is given on two levels, the reply could also have been given on two levels.
Well,
relative, that as long as you think yourself, you will reap the actions.
But since he was looking at two levels, he actually asked a question that doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
If there's nobody doing the action, who gets the results? Okay, and if you can see it that there's no self doing the action, then the action is just done, and that's it. And there are results, and there's no selves involved at all. But he's bringing a self in, so he's asking a question that really doesn't make a lot of sense. So that's why the Buddha answered it at the ultimate level. Because I've taught you many times about dependently arising phenomena. This is what you should be looking at rather than thinking about selves. And so he's trying to teach at this ultimate level.
Yeah.
And if he drops back to the relative level, it probably sows confusion. And only one of those 60 monks maybe got enlightened.
I wonder if it's known how Buddha dealt with the fact that he left his family, his newly born son, as far as I'm told. How did he manage to live with that?
So, how did the Buddha manage to live with leaving his newly born son and going off and pursuing the spiritual path? The fact that the Buddha left his newly born... I mean, the story goes that his son is born, and then that night he sneaks out of the palace and goes off to seek his spiritual fortune. That's the mythology. In the suttas, what we find is that he left, even though his parents didn't want him to and were crying as he left. So this is quite a different picture. His parents know he's leaving, and they're upset about that, and they're watching him go, and they're crying. And it says nothing about his wife and son. Now, indeed, there is this character, Rahula, that shows up in the suttas, and he is a young man, and he grows to be an adult, and when he arrives at adulthood, he has a full awakening, and the Buddha certainly seems to have much more of a connection with him than with any of the other young monks. So, yeah, quite possibly it was his son. Did he leave him the night he was born? Yeah, that's mythology that comes later. It says nothing about that in the suttas. In the Vinaya, the woman who we assume was the Buddha's wife, but it never actually says to Rahula when the Buddha comes back to Kapilavastu, "That's your father. Go ask for your inheritance." And the Buddha makes him a monk. And we get this sense that he was quite young. Traditionally, he's 6 years old. No, he's 9 years old, because this is how old the Buddha was when he came, how many years had elapsed before the Buddha came back. But we also don't want to put the Buddha in light of Western culture. At that time, it was quite common for people to leave their families and go seek their spiritual fortunes. It wasn't looked on in the way that we would look on it. He wasn't abandoning his wife and child so that they had no support. Remember, his father was, well, he probably wasn't a king, but he was the leader of the Sakyans. And so they were in good hands. And so what he was doing was something that wasn't that out of the ordinary for the culture at his time. And so he could live with it because it was a cultural norm, really. That would be the best way I could answer that.
What I thought was maybe some part of his teaching is because he had to construct a kind of mental defense mechanism to live without feeling any sorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to be really careful not to put Western culture on top of the Buddha at that time. I've seen books, in fact, the worst book I ever read on Buddhism was a total projection of 20th century Western psychological culture onto the Buddha. And it made for a terrible book. So I think that more that what he was doing was not so far outside the norm, the cultural norm at that time. So that I rather doubt that he was making up things to soothe his consciousness. And he did go back and collect his wife and son, and they both became fully awakened. So it actually was a pretty good investment.
I suppose Buddha could feel sorrow or grief and that kind of feeling, still if he was awakened.
Yes, when his two chief disciples died, Sariputta and Mahamoggallana, they died within 2 weeks of each other. Sariputta died of an illness, and Mahamoggallana was killed by bandits. And there's a sutta where the Buddha says to the monks, "With Sariputta and Moggallana gone, the light has gone out of this group." Now, that's a pretty tough thing to say, but you get the sense, yeah, he was feeling some grief, yeah. I wouldn't say he was suffering, but it definitely had an effect on him. So, yeah. Do you have a question?
I was just thinking about the 500 gates and the citta, the mind.
Right.
That is created, and the karma that is immediately created right now.
Yes.
Now.
Yes. Right. I
mean, the now mind creates this mind now.
Right.
This mind now, right?
So yeah. So the citta, the mind, is the four mental aggregates, right? So it's vedana, perceptions, mental activities, and consciousness. So an action that is done is certainly going to come back on the aggregate of the aggregates that make up the mind right away. Yeah, definitely. Right. So there could be further actions that happen downstream that come back to the person, the mind-body process that did the action. Yes, definitely. But there's going to be that immediate effect right away. Yeah.
Would the Buddha have conceptualized the soul as, like, say, in an Augustinian way, as the soul flowing around the body and belonging to the body? Or more of, say, Cartesian, where the soul is separate from the body and after death will be separate from the body?
He conceived of the soul as any way you conceive it, you can't find it.
Okay.
Right? So in the culture, it seems that there was a soul that was separate from the body, and that when you died, that soul went to the next body. Or if you were really good, went to have union with the sun. Of course, you couldn't stay there. If you had union with the sun, you died and you came either back to the human realm, or if you were really good while you had union with the sun, maybe you had union with Brahma. But the ultimate was your soul had union with Brahma. And so this was the basic idea of the soul. So a part of you, an essence of you, that is separate from the body. At that time, there were various questions that spiritual teachers mostly took a stand on. Is the world eternal or not? Is the world finite or not? Is the jiva the same as the body? And the jiva would be the life principle, or the soul, you could say. And what happens to an enlightened one after death? Do they exist, not exist, both exist and not exist, neither exist or not exist? And when the Buddha was asked these questions, his reply always was, I don't teach about that. So he never said the life principle is the same as the body or separate from the body. He said that if you look, you can't find a soul. And that's all. So no matter how you conceive of a soul, you can't find it. But the culture was conceiving of it as something separate from the body, for the most part. But there were teachers who conceived of it the same as the body, or the same as the body but survived the death of the body. So there was all sorts of ideas out there.
We get to hear quite often that the presentation that the Buddha gave was so powerful and strong that one or several people immediately got awakened to enlightenment. Apart from the difficulties, of course, of knowing about the operational definition of enlightenment and how they would measure that and who would authorize the degree of, etc. And was it the Buddha who said this, or the commentaries afterwards, etc.?
There, as I say, there are 10 suttas where the Buddha gives a talk, and at the end of it, it says someone or a group of people got awakened. So it's actually in the suttas. So it's not from the commentaries, it's right there in the suttas.
But it still leads to the question about the implicit power of logic and reasoning and listening to concepts and their change on one's character.
Right.
And the question I understand, what about the illogical parts that give us so much trouble, or the obsessive behavior? People are addicted to substances or other things.
Right. So I actually sat down and read all of the suttas through, looking for every place where someone became fully awakened, whether it was through their practice, which was the vast majority of cases, or these few cases where somebody gives a talk and they get awakened. And in every single instance where there's a talk and someone becomes awakened, the people who become awakened have done a lot of practice. So this is a group of monks, and they apparently had done a lot of practice and were pretty close to waking up. They didn't have substance abuse problems or psychological issues that they hadn't worked through. They probably all were, very advanced practitioners. And so the commentaries suggest that the monk who stood up and asked the questions was the leader of this group of 60 monks. And he knew the guys were close, but he didn't know what to do to get them the rest of the way. Now, admittedly, this is from the commentary, so who knows how much we could give this. But they were close, and the Buddha gives a talk, and they wake up. I suspect the reason that none of you woke up when you heard the talk was you weren't close enough, right? So, in every single case, it was people that had done a lot of practice. So the Buddha gives a similar talk to the 5 ascetics he'd practiced with. Well, they'd done a lot of practice beforehand, and they had 2 months of instruction and practice with him before he gave him that talk to wake up. So, I would say that you got to be close. And it doesn't happen very often. As I said, 10 times with the Buddha, 2 with Sariputta, and 1 with Kemaka.
In Western Buddhism, it seems like the Buddha is synonymous with Siddhartha Gautama.
Yes.
How about the other
Buddhas? Do they exist in the suttas, or did
yes.
they become another?
There is a sutta. It's number 14 in the Long Discourses. It's called the Great Discourse on the Lineage. And in that particular sutta, the Buddha tells the names and some details about seven other Buddhas from previous eras. And then he gives the life story of a Buddha named Vipassi, who was a previous Buddha. So the names of previous Buddhas do show up in the suttas. There are a couple other suttas, I think, where previous Buddhas get mentioned. And all of them seem to have a mythological character. In other words, I don't think we should take it as history. But certainly they do show up in the suttas. And after that, there's been quite a bit of, you know, stories and mythology developed around these various Buddhas. So, but yeah, it does show up in the canon.
I'm curious about if you know anything about the Tibetan tradition and their view about the bodhisattvas who choose to be reborn, and they must have a quite good view and knowledge about the ultimate reality. And how do they look at it?
I liked Ayakema's answer to that. She was asked a very similar question. She said, I wouldn't have a clue. So I do have more than a clue, but my understanding of Tibetan Buddhism isn't sufficient that I feel comfortable trying to give an answer about how the Tibetans work with it. But yeah, the Tibetans have this tradition of rebirth and reincarnation. So our current Dalai Lama is the 14th one. So he's been here 13 times before. And how all that works and everything else, I could give you my speculations and I can try and say what they say, but I think it's probably wisest to say, yeah, I have to leave that in the I don't know category. Okay. Judith?
So while I'm listening to you, this is a reflection. It's just mind-blowing to hear about you talk about this dependent origination. Like everything relates to everything?
No, it's not everything relates to everything. Everything relates to other things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And everything changes all the time. And the same simultaneously, there is, like, the heart is the heart and complete, and yet it's part of a bigger whole.
Yeah.
And so it's so sad to see that we, 2,500 years after Buddha's teaching of Buddha lived, still live in a world of separation.
Right.
And I'm just remembering the last sentence I read in the paper was that there hasn't been so many refugees since the end of the Second World War.
Right.
We live in the separateness and the growing nationalism and racism. And in a sense, it's very sad.
Yeah, it really is. Humanity has not grown up.
Not very much. Very small steps. Yeah. And on the other hand, I don't know what I'm trying to support myself.
Yeah.
In that while the pollution and this big problem might also be part of the opening for awareness that we are faced with such an invasive.
Right. Things are going to change, and they're going to change quite dramatically. I mean, it just can't go on like this. This is for sure. And how it all plays out is very much unknown. And it could play out disastrous for most people, or it could play out such that we wind up in a much better world. And, yeah, it's going to depend on how much of that connection that we recognize. If everybody goes for their own selfish ends, yeah, it's going to be really disastrous. But if everybody starts to recognize, or if enough people start to recognize the interrelatedness, the interconnections that are happening, yeah, it could actually be a very positive change. And I have no idea. The Buddha said, there are only a few with little dust in their eyes. So, yeah, 2,500 years of dusty eyes wandering around, we've got quite a mess on our hands.
It seems to be for some or for many when there is a direct confrontation or exposure. for what is going on. Like in Denmark, which has now become very xenophobic, in this the country in Europe who are most against refugees,
yeah,
immigrants. But now, just before I went, there was a complete change because there was so many thousands of refugees coming to the
right
borders, and the government didn't know what to do. But the people, suddenly there were so many volunteers coming to the borders and to support. So there was a new process coming forward.
Oh, good, good.
People said, well, now when they see a human being or the first child walking with bare foot,
yeah,
etc., they just couldn't help.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, the goodness to solve these problems in a way that is beneficial for all of us is there. It's just, will there be leadership? Will there be enough effort? Yeah.
To say, we have this technical equipment, this technical
right
evolution that are so...
Yeah, we have the ability to communicate unlike we've ever communicated before. So how it plays out is going to be very interesting. Of course, there's the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. I think we've all there. Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen, but...
Are you part of this Taoist or Buddhist group or coming together who faces this issues?
I'm sort of on the very edge of those sort of groups. I'm not very active in it. Part of it because I don't live anywhere. So it's not like I can go to the meetings they're having locally because I don't have a local. So, but yeah, I do support what they're doing and I try and bring it up in my retreats. And yeah, I'm on the mailing list and so forth. Yeah. The teaching of the Buddha is definitely to wake up and you have to be responsible for it. But we're in such a mess right now, we're also going to have to work on that part as well. Yeah.
But it's not in Buddha's teaching.
Not really. No. What's in his teaching is to act out of compassion. That's definitely in there. If you encounter dukkha, do what you can to alleviate the dukkha. So that's part of the path to awakening. Because... Yeah, if you're going out of your way to alleviate dukkha, then you're not acting as selfish. The less selfish you act, the more chance you have of waking up. So although it's not explicitly mentioned about saving the world, it's certainly explicitly mentioned about acting out of compassion. And it's just that right now we have lots of opportunities that need a lot of compassionate action. But yeah, you shouldn't abandon your project of waking up. You should do both. And to what degree you're putting your energy into both of these, you're going to have to figure that out for yourself.
Little dust in the eyes, is that defilements?
It would be anything that obscures your vision of what's really happening. And so defilements would definitely be one of the particle or multiple particles of dust. Yeah.
Stone.
Right. But there are other things, just ignorance. Yeah, you don't know about stuff. So that's a possibility too.
Yeah. It's
small. I just wanted to say what Judith said, that yeah, it's so beautiful to see the whole Sweden also opening arms and
yeah.
And, you know, helping out. But you know, it's we should be happy for it now. Be forgotten, you know, we have to work on our own metta towards ourselves,
yeah,
and create peace in ourselves. I mean, it sounds like a big word, maybe, but it's really true, I think, to
yeah,
have peace inside.
Right, we have to work on ourselves because ain't nobody else going to do it, yeah, and we also have to reach out and help others as well. This is not the last refugee crisis we're going to see. As global warming kicks in and sea levels rise, I mean, half of Bangladesh is going to disappear.
We are forced to open our hearts.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the world is, you know.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time. Yeah, maybe a little too interesting, but we have to deal with it.
when we are compassionate towards somebody else, are we not, in a sense, elevating their selfness? If you get what I mean.
Well, in a sense, but we're also putting them in a place where maybe they can get some of the dust out of their eyes and see beyond their self. If someone's struggling for survival, there's no way they're going to have a chance to advance on the spiritual path. They're struggling for survival. That's taking their whole, all the energy they have. So sometimes, yeah, it's like, okay, we set you up and we make sure that you can survive, because otherwise there's no chance of you waking up. And it may, at that point, yeah, increase their sense of self. But you can't overcome the sense of self by just going, I don't have a self, I don't have a self. And you can't overcome somebody else's by saying, you don't have a self, you don't have a self. You got to feel it. But in order to feel it, you're going to have to do the practice. In order to do the practice, you're going to need a lifestyle that supports doing practice. And yeah, if you're a refugee, it's not a lifestyle that's going to support that. So yeah, temporarily there may be an increase in their self and so forth, but that's a minor thing compared to starving to death.
That question gave me another thought that what do you say about that we have the suffering to be grateful for, that we have found Dhamma? Mm-hmm. I think many people can feel that, because if life was just smooth, we wouldn't have an urge,
right,
to search for this.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like a paradox, you can say. We need the suffering to get rid of the suffering.
Yeah. I came up with, say, dukkha is our best teacher. Just think about it. When things go well, you don't learn anything. You don't change. You just stay the same and enjoy things going well. But they never continue to go well forever. It changes. And then, oh, I got to do something about this. So, yeah, the dukkha does prod us into doing things that actually take us to a better place than where we were sitting before we got the dukkha. Yeah. It seems that human beings don't learn from when things go right. They just, yeah, sit there and enjoy it.
The only thing we learn is that we never learn.
Right. But we do seem to learn when things go wrong. It's like painful enough that we finally get in there and do some work and make things better. And so, yeah, there's a potential for a lot of things to go wrong now. So hopefully we learn a lot, because otherwise it's going to be a lot of dukkha.
Maybe it's very good that Buddha didn't make an imperative of saving the world, because if you look at the movements who have tried to save the world, it hasn't been that
successful, right?
So the other way of trying to just save yourself, in a sense, create peace in what seems to be, even if small drops.
Yes.
It,
yeah,
seems to be maybe more fruitful.
Right. Yeah, he identified the basic problem. Dukkha happens. And he's like, okay, I'll tell you how to work on that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And once you've managed to do that, then you can be a lot more beneficial. But yeah, you got to work on yourself for sure.
There was a sutta about that starts with dukkha. It's a sutta about dependent origination that starts with, or ends with, dukkha as
There are suttas that start with dukkha about dependent origination.
And where Buddha is talking about dukkha as what is
a friend.
What do you say? There's some
teacher.
It goes on.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly which
you were talking about the sutta where it goes where. Some disciple asks him what goes before that.
Yeah, right.
And it comes back to dukkha.
It actually winds up at ignorance.
Ignorance.
Yeah. So why does dukkha arise? Well, because you got born. Why'd you get born? Well, Mother Nature has this urge to become. right, and on back through the links, all the way to ignorance. And then Ananda asks, and where does ignorance come from? And the Buddha says, you've gone too far, Ananda. Ignorance has been there since beginningless time. Because, I mean, think about it. You arrive here, you got born, you were ignorant of everything, except maybe you needed something to eat, right? And you ignored the rest of the universe. And it was only over time that you begin to dispel some ignorance. Ignorance is sort of like what's here to start with. But yeah, Ananda asks, where does dukkha come from? Well, it comes from the fact that you were born. You incarnate in human form, and there's going to be dukkha happen. Well, why bother to be born? Mother Nature has this urge to become. I'll go into it in detail tonight.
I was just wondering about the Metta Sutta.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that Buddha wasn't practicing the Metta, like a meditation practice.
No, he definitely was practicing Metta as a meditation practice. There are 15 or 20 suttas where he gives it as a practice to do. Interestingly enough, he says, do the first jhana and do metta practice then. Okay, so the thinking in the first jhana, the vitakka vichara, yeah, you can do metta practice at that point by thinking the metta phrases, by doing the metta practice. Okay, so that's one way of working with it. If you try and do that, keep the PT at a really low level, okay? I found that it didn't work so well to have a lot of PT and try and do metta practice. It led to unwanted side effects. Did the bell ring?
Yes.
Okay. So,
thank you.
Enjoy your lunch. And I think three people who have not signed up, please sign up for your interview.